Max TV, the fastest growing news channel in America. Watch it on all major cable systems and see shows with Sean Spicer, Greg Kelly, Lindsay Keith, Stinchfield, and Rob Schmidt. They're giving you the real story on Biden and Pelosi. So download the free Newsmax app on your smartphone now or watch Newsmax on Roku, YouTube, Pluto, Zumo, and more. 30 million Americans watch Newsmax TV. So should you.
Well, it's starting out to be another record day on Wall Street. Fox's Lillian Wu watching stocks live here in New York.
Dave, the buying continues on Wall Street as major indices hit fresh all-time highs. The Dow, which snapped a six-day winning streak yesterday, is up 90 points. S&P adding 15, and NASDAQ almost 90. Twitter doing especially well, surging about 12% after beating earnings and revenue expectations. And consumer prices edged up 0.3% last month, Dave, led by a surge in energy.
Yeah, and the price of oil just keeps going up a little bit more today, above $58 a barrel. Gas is up slightly. AAA's national average for regular now almost $2.48 per gallon. That's a nickel more than a year ago. There's more pushback to President Biden canceling the Keystone Oil Pipeline project. Democratic Senator Joe Manchin is urging him to reverse that decision. Unions say it's put people out of work and will kill thousands more jobs. Republican Congressman Dusty Johnson from South Dakota is working on a bill.
It would basically take away the power of the president to be able to destroy a massive project like this.
Now, President Biden says the Keystone Pipeline goes against his economic and climate imperatives, and his administration has touted the jobs that will be created transitioning to cleaner energy. An NBA team has taken a fast break from the national anthem and all the controversy about protests. The Dallas Mavericks haven't played the anthem before a game at home all season, which no one noticed with no fans there. But then that came out in the reports, and owner Mark Cuban says he has no plans to bring the anthem back.
Cuban's been a vocal supporter of those who wish to kneel during the playing of the anthem. An NBA spokesman says under the unique circumstances of this season, teams are permitted to run their pregame operations as they see fit.
Fox's Sal Giangrasso, the Dallas Mavericks did have fans at a game Monday night for the first time. 1,500 essential workers were allowed in free. I'm Dave Anthony. This is Fox News.
This is Niagara County's information station and the new home of Fox News Radio, streaming worldwide at WLVL.com. I'm Hank Nevins. Eight more virus deaths were announced yesterday at the Niagara County Health Department's COVID update. They also reported 77 new cases, bringing to 899 the total number of active cases in Niagara County. There was also some good news yesterday in New York's efforts to vaccinate people against COVID-19. Over the next 3 weeks, the federal government will boost the state's supply of vaccine by 5%. Even with that increase, it's still likely to take several months to fully vaccinate all New Yorkers. Health officials in nearby Erie County have started the process of rescheduling canceled vaccination appointments. Clinics that were supposed to be held in late January were put on hold due to a shortage of vaccine. Those affected by the postponements should check their email this week for their new date and time. Meanwhile, Erie County is taking another step to prevent a spike in the number of new virus cases. All residents can now get a free COVID-19 test through the county health department. Previously, the screenings were only available to people with virus symptoms. Testing will identify those who are asymptomatic and keep them from spreading the disease to others. To set up an appointment, you can call the Erie County COVID information line. A convicted felon is behind bars finally after a one-man crime spree across six western New York counties. 61-year-old Patrick Feuer is facing scores of drug charges and traffic violations. His frenzy of dangerous driving and reckless behavior spans 5 months. Feuer's felony record dates back at least 12 years, and his driver's license has been suspended or revoked 13 times. State police arrested him in late January after pulling him over on the thruway. Wyoming County DA Donald O'Green finally got Fuhr in front of a judge, and now he's in the Wyoming County Jail. Five arrests on driving under the influence charges from area police reports. 22-year-old Kadir Wilson of South Street was written up by LPD about 5 Saturday morning after they found him asleep at the wheel on Lincoln Avenue. He's also facing another 3 traffic violations. Even earlier Saturday morning, 31-year-old Cody Carson of Newfane was charged by LPD with DUI and a pair of equipment violations. Late Friday, Lockport officers arrested 33-year-old Kaquan Palmer of Price Street. He was cited on the DUI charge and other violations after his vehicle slid into a sign on High Street. In Pendleton, 57-year-old Curtis Berg was stopped and charged by deputies not far from his Lockport Road home. That happened Saturday night just after 11. And in Newfane, 45-year-old Jason Miller of Hatter Road was written up by deputies for DUI and 2 additional charges late last week. Congressman Tom Reed continued his recent criticism of Governor Cuomo during a trip to Albany. The 23rd District Republican was at the state capitol yesterday, accusing the governor of being responsible for the virus-related deaths of thousands of nursing home residents. He also expressed hope that the Justice Department would look into the matter and hold the governor accountable. In regional news, no injuries were reported after a massive fire ravaged an apartment building in suburban Rochester when fire crews arrived at the scene on Countess Drive in Henrietta yesterday. Part of the structure had already collapsed. 14 people were displaced by the blaze. They are currently under the care of the Red Cross. And with more frigid February weather this week, the city of Lockport's code blue continues in place through Saturday. The warming shelter at the Salvation Army at Walnut and Cottage will be open overnights from 8 p.m. until 8 a.m. Doors close at 10 o'clock. Finally, you may have heard this one. Major League Baseball is making changes to its baseballs in an effort to reduce the soaring home run totals. The Athletic, that's a magazine, it obtained a memo sent to front offices last week outlining the changes which are intended to deaden the ball. The report also says 5 more teams will begin using a humidor to store balls at their home parks, joining 5 others, including the Diamondbacks and Rockies, that have used the tactic to cut down on home runs. MLB teams hit a record 6,776 homers in 2019. They averaged a record 1.39 home runs per game that year. That's a huge increase from 1.15 in 2018. The average during the shortened 2020 season was 1.28 homers per game. WLVL Niagara weather. For today and tomorrow, expect scattered snow showers early, followed by increasing clouds both days and a high of 23. For tonight, mostly cloudy with the low 13. That's a look at the news and weather. I'm Hank Nevins.
Let's take a trip down memory lane with Niagara County's Great History Show. Now, here's your host, Norm Palmer.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the show this morning on this beautiful sunshine and, as Hank said, frigid Wednesday afternoon. In the guest studio with me, we have the executive director of the Niagara County History Center, Melissa Dunlap, and her assistant, Anne-Marie Lineberry. Good morning, ladies.
Morning.
Good morning.
Okay, we're ready to roll today. I heard your topic mentioned, and I'm thinking, what a great time to have this in the month.
Okay. Well, we're going to start with that this is our 100th anniversary for the Society. It started in 1921, and we are not celebrating like we thought we would, but Anne-Marie has been writing some articles that have been in the newspaper, and I think we'll probably get those on our website. We also are thinking that later in the year, if things get a little better, we could do some events or maybe something virtual. We do have a new YouTube channel. It's called the History Center Lockport. So you go into YouTube and you type in the History Center Lockport and click subscribe, and then you can see the YouTube programs that are already on there. I'm not sure exactly how many are on there right now. I checked the other day and there were less than I thought, so hopefully we've gotten those up. But for the first time ever this week, we did a live Facebook program. So now we're starting to get some live things on Facebook. So in this virtual world, we're trying to catch up and do what we need to so that we are still connected with all of our members and all of our radio listeners and the public. So that's probably about what we're doing. Okay. We are going to talk about African Americans locally, and then also a little bit about the Tuskegee Airmen, which of course was an air group during World War II. And we'll kind of start with the Mosell family. A lot of you might be familiar with them, but maybe some of you aren't. Aaron Mosell was African-American, and he was born in Baltimore, and so was his wife, Eliza. He learned his brick trade in Baltimore, and then after he and Eliza got married, they moved to Canada, and Aaron worked in a brickyard in Hamilton. And then they moved to Lockport, where he built his own brickyard. And his 10-acre brickyard extended from Trowbridge Street to where North Park Middle School is today. He was a good employer in the local area. At one time, he had close to 50 employees. And he was a very successful businessman. And he could do all the mathematical calculations of how many bricks were needed for the building or space or road right in his head. So there was even a time when they had to go and seek his advice because other people could not figure that out. He and his son Charles built the commercial hotel, which was on Pine Street near Walnut, and that was called the, what was that called later on?
The Walpine.
Walpine, thank you.
That was afterwards, yeah.
And it was a beautiful hotel. It was opened in May 27th, 1886, and was worth $35,000. So that would have been very much at that time. It had steam heat and was lighted with gas and electricity. There were 41 guest rooms, all with modern improvements and comforts that money could procure. So Aaron Mosell also donated all the bricks for the Lockport AME Church on South Street, and that church is still used today. We do have the lentil from the commercial hotel at the museum. So in the early 1870s, the family was living at 54 High Street, and Mr. Mosell donated the bricks for the new school on High Street, which is where John Pound is today, hoping that his children could attend there because they could have walked across the street. But he had to fight to get that done. The whole school burned down in 1907. Unfortunately, the only photo we have of it is after it burned. And then John Pound School was built right on the same property. So Aaron and his son Charles fought to get the Lockport schools integrated, and they started the process by going to the Board of Education in 1872. And the board vacillated. First they said yes, then they said no, then they said yes. But it was finally accomplished in 1876. The schools were integrated in Lockport, New York, and that is really early. So we do have some photos of the schools integrated from the 1890s, because that seems to be the start of the popular school photos. Okay, so Reverend Charles Mosell, one of Aaron's sons, graduated from Lincoln University in 1872 and Boston University of Theology in 1874. He and his family were missionaries in Haiti, and his sister, sometimes it's Alvaretta and sometimes it's Alvarilla, went, and she also got sick and perished there. He was the pastor of the Buffalo Vine Street School, or church, in 1893, which is now the Bethel AME Church in Buffalo. He then moved to Baltimore. He returned to Lockport to write his 500-book page, oh boy, page book, Hero of St. Domingo. I can't tell you what the French is. And then moved to Baltimore, where he ended his career. Another son, Nathan, graduated from Lincoln University in 1879, and he was at the University of Pennsylvania in 1882. He was the first African-American to get a medical degree at the University of Pennsylvania. He founded the Frederick Douglass Memorial Hospital in Philadelphia, was the first African-American member of the Philadelphia County Medical Society, and was the founder of the city NAACP chapter. After 1946, the Frederick Douglass Hospital merged with the Mercy Hospital to become Mercy Douglass Hospital, and it closed in 1973. Another son, Aaron Albert Mozell Jr., graduated from Lincoln University in 1885. He was the first African-American to earn a law degree from the University of Pennsylvania in 1888. After 1 year of study under D.E. Braung, the Niagara County District Attorney, he was admitted to the New York Bar. He then moved to practice law in Philadelphia, and in 1889, he left his family to live in Cardiff, Wales. Mary Elizabeth Mozell was the oldest child. She was born in Baltimore in 1847. When the family moved to Lockport, she finished her school but was still living at home. In the 1870 census, her occupation was listed as fancy needlework. By 1875, she's listed as a hairdresser. In 1883, she married Abraham Parker Denny of Westchester, Pennsylvania, and she may have met them through her brothers who were attending the University of Philadelphia at the time, Pennsylvania and Philadelphia. She and Abraham moved to Princeton, New Jersey, where Mary raised their two daughters. Alvaretta Mozell was born in 1858 between Nathan and Aaron, and she went with her brother Charles, as we said, to Haiti as a missionary. Charles and Mary Ella also had a child while in Haiti who did not survive, and Mary Ella returned to the United States ill and passed away in 1886. Another child of Aaron and Eliza Mozell was James. He was born in Hamilton in 1853, and he died in Lockport in 1869 at the age of 16. So, the legacy continues. Education has become a hallmark for the Mozell family. Each generation has received advanced degrees and distinguished the family in many different fields of study. Aaron Mozell's educational legacy started in Lockport and was spread by his family and descendants about the importance of education for everyone. The granddaughter of Aaron Mozell, Sadie Tanner Mozell Alexander, she was one of the first African Americans to receive a Ph.D. in economics in the United States and the first woman to receive a law degree from the University of Pennsylvania and be admitted to the Pennsylvania Bar in 1927. After a very long and distinguished career, she retired in 1976. There's a school named for her in Philadelphia. As the family goes on, Sadie Tanner Mozell married Raymond Pace Alexander, and Raymond Pace Alexander was a Wharton School and Harvard Law graduate. He and Sadie were pioneers for civil rights in Philadelphia. Their daughter, Ray Alexander Minter, Ph.D., was the vice president of the Metropolitan College, formerly the Audrey Cohen College. She has been promoting the contributions of African Americans to the nation's culture. Now, Dr. Minter has come to Lockport on three or four occasions that I know of, and she has spoken here, and she is very interested in keeping the history of the Mozells here alive. And then Henry Oswana Tanner, he was the first African-American painter to gain international acclaim. In 1879, he attended the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts in Philadelphia. Robin Wanamaker sponsored him for a trip to Palestine in 1890, and Wanamaker's was a huge store in Philadelphia because of his art with biblical themes. And in 1891, he moved to Paris and was accepted in French artistic circles. Except for brief trips home, he spent the rest of his life there. His work is shown all over the world. Tanner's Sun Dunes at Sunset in Atlantic City was the first painting by an African-American artist to be purchased for the permanent collection at the White House, and it was purchased during the Clinton administration. So it's just a really wonderful family. They've really promoted education, but they did so much for Lockport by getting the schools integrated by 1876.
433-1433 if you have a question or a comment about Black History Month is as we know it. And my personal opinion about the Moselle family is that one of the schools in Lockport, as far as I'm concerned, should be called Moselle. Yep. And I know there was an effort to do that, and it didn't make it yet, but
we're still trying.
I think with all of the accomplishments in education and all of the stuff, as George Carlin would say, that they did for education, I think it's sad that one school in all the schools that we have could not be named after Mr. Moselle.
And his brickyard was right at North Park, and that's the only school not named for a person in Lockport.
Yes. So if you have any comments or any questions, give us a call, 433-1433.
Well, long before Aaron Moselle even came to Lockport, there was an African-American community as early as the time that the canal was being built. There was a story about a barber who tried to take him. The slave catchers from Kentucky, I think it was, tried to take him at the time of the canal, 1821, and he was actually rescued by some of the canal workers. And so the African-American community, actually the area where most of them settled was South Street, Washburn Street, Elm Street area. And by 1835, there was actually enough of a community here that they decided to build a church. And there was, in the newspaper, there was a notice that said that they were resolved to raise by subscription $150 to erect a suitable building for a school, a schoolhouse, and a public place of worship. And even though the chronology and location of that first church is a little confusing, it appears that it was actually on South Street, but closer to Locust Street. And but then in 1844, Lyman and Amy Spaulding, obviously many people are familiar with Lyman Spaulding. He was a businessman here in Lockport. He was also an abolitionist. And they donated a lot on South Street, closer to Washburn Street, so that they, the AME Church, could build a more substantial building there. And so in 1844, another building was built on that lot. And for 3 years, the whole community worshipped at that church. However, in 1847, there was some sort of a dispute in the church, and some of the congregation left and started another church, which, again, was down at South Street near Locust Street. And that church became the Bethel Church, and the church that is now on where it is currently on South Street, the church there, even though at that time it was just a wood frame building, that became the Zion AME Church. And those both of those churches were very active during these years. They were active. They did a lot of fundraisers for the abolitionist movement, trying to help their brethren that were still enslaved in the South. And then after the end of the Civil War and emancipation, they were trying to help those that were newly freed as well. So there was a lot of things going on in both of those churches. And in 1863, the Zion Church played host to Frederick Douglass. And he spoke here. In fact, he spoke here in Lockport on a number of occasions. And he felt he wanted to ask the people to consider your duties in the present crisis of national affairs. And as I said, there was a lot of fundraising going on for the newly freed slaves down in the South. He came to Lockport 5 years later in 1868 and spoke again, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. But in 1876, Aaron Mozell, who Melissa had just spoken about, felt that the two churches, the two AME churches, Bethel and Zion, that they should not be separated, that they should be one congregation, and the community would be stronger if they were one congregation. So at about the same time that he was fighting to have the Lockport schools integrated, he was also trying to get these two churches to merge again. And this finally happened in 1876. So two events in that community in 1876. And it was decided that the congregation would follow the Bethel form of jurisdiction, but that the congregation would worship at the Zion Church, which is the one that was closest to Washburn Street. And Aaron Mozell, seeing that the two congregations were now going to merge and would need a bigger space, it was at that time that he donated the bricks to build this church that is currently on South Street. So that's how that all came about.
Okay, we have a call coming in, man. Sure. Marie, let's take our call. Good morning. You're on Niagara County's Great History Show. You are on. Go ahead. Go ahead. Well, I don't know. They were not listening, evidently. So go ahead, Anne Marie. If they call back, we'll put them on. 433-1433. Or comment?
Melissa's going
to... I was just going to say, you were talking about Lyman and Amy Spalding, and they were Quakers. There was a large Quaker community here, which also helped to lead to having all the abolitionists.
Yes. There was a very large abolitionist community here. And I'll just mention briefly about Harriet Tubman before we go on to Frederick Douglass again. Harriet Tubman, of course, is well known as being a conductor on the Underground Railroad. And primarily in the 1840s, 1850s, Harriet did bring fugitive slaves up through this area into Niagara Falls. Don't think she got as far as Lockport, but Niagara Falls, possibly the Lewiston area, but she did use the old suspension bridge in Niagara Falls, and there's one instance where she was bringing a group over, and one of the men in the group was so terrified that they weren't going to make it across that he would not look out the window to look at Niagara Falls, and she kind of badgered him about it and said, "Take a look at it." So finally he did, but they did make it across and into freedom. So, and she made a number of trips up here at that time.
Yeah, there was the Harriet movie was on Netflix, but I think they just took it off this month. People could look and see if it's still on there.
So in August of 1868, Frederick Douglass did visit Lockport again. And this was actually for a celebration of the, it was the 29th anniversary of the emancipation of slaves in the British West Indies. And so he was here for that celebration. That was a large celebration in the African American community in Lockport. And so he spoke. He spoke about voting rights and election franchise. At that time, because even in 1868, there was already beginning, even though African-American men had the right to vote, there was voter suppression in the South. And he was addressing that here in Lockport and basically calling for justice on behalf of the newly enfranchised African-American men. And that actually took place in front of the old courthouse at Courthouse Square. And then afterwards, there was a very large reception at two different hotels here in Lockport. I just saw the names of them here. Oh, okay. It was the Pavilion Hotel and the Exchange Hotel. And everyone, both black and white, were invited to partake at the reception at these hotels. And then following that, there was a baseball game I know, Norm, you're a big fan of baseball. There was a baseball game at the corner of South and Erie Streets, and the teams were the Excelsior Baseball Club, which was from here in Lockport, and then the other club was the Niagara Falls Club. And these were both clubs formed of African-American men, and they played the game, and a large crowd, saying both black and white spectators, watched the game, had a great time, and unfortunately the Niagara Falls team beat the Lockport team on that game, but it was admitted that the Niagara Falls club had a slightly better team than the Lockport did at that group. And then, to top it all off, in the evening there was a grand party given at Ringenberg Hall, and I probably will not pronounce the name of this school correctly. The Terpeshanian School of Dance performed at the ball, and everything went off very well. And the newspaper commented several times about how the crowd was composed of both blacks and whites, how everyone got along peacefully, everybody had a great time, and it showed that people could and can get together and have a good time, despite, you know, the difference in races or ethnicities. So,
and I would imagine if there was an outfield fence, there was a lot of balls hit over that fence, because a lot of my friends that were black that played baseball, they could whack the ball something fierce. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. You are listening to Niagara County's Great History Show, 1340 AM, 105.3 FM.
Sub Delicious Downtown, 15 Locust Street, offers free delivery.
Day. What a great
Sub
idea.
Delicious
Visit
Downtown offers freshness and quality every day in all they serve. Introducing a new menu item, a brisket sandwich with fries, or a brisket hoagie, 6 or 12 inch. Plus, Sub Delicious Downtown's pizza, wings, wraps, salad, soups, chili, and more. Sub Delicious is open every day, 9 a.m. to 1 a.m. for your late night cravings. Call 433-6667. Don't forget, free delivery in the city.
Davison Road Inn, offering comfort food, a large selection of craft beers, and drink specials every day. Join them for happy hour, 4 to 6 weekdays. DRI opens at 4 p.m. Tuesday through Friday, noon on Saturday, and Sunday, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. for brunch. Visit DavisonRoadIn.com for the full menu. DRI's dining room is open within New York State guidelines, and takeout and curbside pickup is available. Just call 434-8444. Davison Road Inn, 383 Davison Road. Stop in and say hi to Mark. DRI, where friends meet friends.
The Dave Ramsey Show, where common sense meets dollars and cents.
If you want to be normal, do what normal people do. Think about that. What's normal in America? Normal is a student loan that's been around so long you think it's a pet. Normal is a car payment and a fleece payment on the other car. Normal is all the money comes in, all the money goes out, and only the names are changed to protect the innocent. Who the flip wants to be normal? That's just stupid. Normal is stupid on steroids.
The Dave Ramsey Show, now heard weeknights 8 to 11 on WLVL.
Darren College, a former NFL Super Bowl champion, signed the most important contract of his life to serve in the Army National Guard.
The National Guard for me was a perfect fit. I've had a lot of military in my family. It's a big part of what my family's done for a long time. I want to go out there and make a difference. I want to be a part of something bigger than myself. I didn't find that in the normal day-to-day life. I didn't find that working behind a desk. I realized being hands-on and being a soldier was something that would keep me active, keep me outside, keep me in that team environment that I craved and that I needed so much. And then the opportunity to serve my community and serve my country was just icing on the cake. I wanted to be in Boise, Idaho. I wanted to be home. The National Guard gave me the opportunity to stay right where I was, serve my country and my community, and it was the best of both worlds. I grew up flying bush planes in Alaska with my dad. I was fortunate enough to get my pilot's license. I wanted to be in helicopters. I wanted to be a crew chief. The Army National Guard gave me a chance to fly helicopters now instead of fixed-wing aircraft.
To learn how to be part of the Army National Guard, log on to NationalGuard.com. Sponsored by the New York Army National Guard. Aired by the New York State Broadcasters Association and this station.
Welcome back to Niagara County's Great History Show. In the studio with me today, the Executive Director of Niagara County History Center, Melissa Dunlap, and her assistant, Anne-Marie Linneberry. I call her the Storyteller Lady because she writes some wonderful stories. Okay, ladies.
I don't know if you...
go ahead.
I just wanted to mention there were two people that were connected with the early years of the AME Church that I did a little bit of research on. you know, you hear so much about the Mosels and some of the other people, not only African-Americans, but, you know, people here in Lockport that were business leaders or political leaders. But sometimes it's interesting to find out a little bit about people that, you know, just had ordinary lives and, you know, weren't so prominent. And two people that were associated with the early AME church, Woodford Mills. Now, Woodford Mills actually lived right next door to the AME church at the corner of, on South Street at the corner of Washburn. And he was named as one of the first trustees of the AME church. And this was in 1844. And he was one of the oldest members of the church at that time. He had been born into slavery in Kentucky in 1793. He had escaped, came up into Canada, and actually was in the British Army, or I'm sorry, the British Navy, I should say, for a number of years. And then he married while he was in Canada, and he came to Lockport. And his occupation was listed as laborer. It never said where he worked, but he was very active in the community. He was very active in the church. His name appeared in the newspaper several times in relation to activities in the church. Also, there were political clubs, African-American political clubs here in Lockport, and he belonged to those clubs. There was the African-American Voters Club. There was a Grant Club that several people were involved in as well. And then there were social clubs. So in those days, a lot of times people's names would appear in the newspaper in relation to these different clubs and activities. And so his name appeared several times. He died in 1870 at the age of 87 years old. So he was, as I said, he was probably at that point, if not the oldest, one of the oldest members of the church and the African-American community. Another gentleman who also was a trustee of the church was James Morgan. And James Morgan was born in Maryland, again, into slavery in about 1800. The first time he shows up in Lockport is in the mid-1830s. And as I mentioned, Mr. Mills lived on South Street and Washburn. James Morgan and his family also lived on South Street, west of the AME church, and he was a barber, and he had two sons, James and then Theodore. They were both barbers as well. After a while, you don't see too much in the newspapers about James Morgan, but Theodore Morgan, his younger son, had a very successful barber business at number one Main Street, which was above the Renfrew and Tarbox's hardware store. And it was there for a number of years. But one of the interesting things was that he and several other barbers, both black and white, placed a notice in the Lockport Journal and Courier asking that they allow to be closed on Sundays to observe the Sabbath. And as a consequence, they agreed to stay open until midnight on Saturday night so people could get their hair cut. So to have to ask for that kind of a concession, to have, you know, to be closed on Sunday so that you can go to church to worship, we wouldn't even think about that now. It would be their prerogative if they wanted to close on Sunday. But they did accomplish that. And Theodore's wife also was a hairdresser. As we mentioned, Aaron Mosell's daughter was a hairdresser, and so was her name was Lavinia Morgan, and it said that Mrs. T.W. Morgan has opened a room adjoining her husband's barbershop for a ladies' hairdressing establishment where ladies will find it to their advantage to call for anything in the hairdressing line. Theodore Morgan was also a musician, and he and his, Lavinia was his mother. I'm sorry, his wife was Arabella. So Arabella and Theodore were both very active in organizing community balls and concerts, and they usually did this for the benefit of an individual or a group one woman in the community, her house burned down, and they had a benefit concert for her to raise money to rebuild her house. Also, for the victims of the Great Chicago Fire in 1871. And so they were very successful, and just like the others, they were very active in the church. They were active, Theodore was active in the political clubs, and they were active in social affairs and social activities as well. And so it's interesting to see that, you know, there were everyday people that had everyday jobs that, you know, didn't make as much money, but they didn't have as much influence or notoriety as some people did. And But they made an impact. They made an impact. They made a great contribution to the community and to Lockport in general.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about the Tuskegee Airmen. That group was active from 1940 to 1948. And all black military pilots who trained in the United States trained at Moton Field, the Tuskegee Army Airfield, and were educated at the Tuskegee University located near Tuskegee, Alabama. The group included five Haitians from the Haitian Air Force, one pilot from Trinidad, and also included Hispanic or Latino airmen born in the Dominican Republic. The squadron, the 332nd Fighter Group, which originally included the 100th, 301st, and 202nd Fighter Group squadrons, was the first black flying group. It deployed to Italy in early 1944. And in June 1944, the 332nd Fighter Group began flying heavy bomber escort missions. And in July 1944, with the addition of the 99th Fighter Squadron, it had four fighter squadrons. So they were equipped with Curtiss P-40 Warhawk fighter bomber craft. And they later did combat missions with Bell P-39 Air Cobras. And later with Republic P-47 Thunderbolts, for people that actually know about planes. And finally, the aircraft which they became most commonly associated was the North American P-51 Mustang. When the pilots of the 332nd Fighter Group painted the tails of their P-47s red, the nickname Red Tails was coined. The red markings that distinguished the Tuskegee Airmen included red bands on the noses of P-51s as well as red rudder. And the P-51B and D Mustangs flew with similar color schemes with red propeller spinners, yellow wing bands, and all red tail surfaces. They were a branch originally of the Army Air Corps, which then became the Army Air Forces, which became the United States Army Air Force. They were trained
to change that. It's United States Air Force.
United States Air Force.
Yeah, my brother went in before me 18 years, and he was in the Army Air Corps, and we always had that disagreement, but they turned it and dropped the Army part of it, and we were just Air Force.
Yeah, okay. United States Air Force. And then they were trained for aerial combat. There were 992 Tuskegee Airmen. 84 of them lost their lives. 68 were killed in action, and 32 were captured as POWs, and then some of them died. They earned three distinguished unit citations. Four airmen had completed training as pilots, bombardiers, and navigators. They may have been the only triple qualified officers in the entire Air Corps at that time. 14,000 personnel trained for critical operation supports to pilots and aircraft of that group. Training for the Tuskegee Airmen also was done in Mississippi, Texas, New Jersey, New York, Georgia, and Wisconsin. 17 flight surgeons served with the Tuskegee Airmen from 1941 to 1949. Enlisted men were needed for the program to succeed. So you had aircraft mechanics, you had female machinists, you had motor pool people, an armorer, a crew chief, cooks, and stenographers, all to help this group run. So there weren't any actually in Lockport, but there were two Tuskegee Airmen from Buffalo. One was Lieutenant Henry Pollard. He was a former orchestra leader and saxophonist in Jimmy Lunsford's band, and his parents lived on Madison Street in Lockport. He was killed in an airplane crash in Italy 8 days after joining a Thunderbolt fighter squadron. He graduated from Fosdick-Maston Park High School and Syracuse University. He was a member of the American Federation of Musicians. Before his induction into the Air Corps on June 9, 1942, he led his own orchestra in various Buffalo nightclubs. After serving with the military police unit at Oswego and attaining the rank of staff surgeon, he applied for pilot training. He was commissioned on December 5, 1943, after winning his wings at Tuskegee Institute. Before going to Italy, he was in North Africa. So he, unfortunately, was killed in action. And the second one from Buffalo was Second Lieutenant Johnson C. Wells, 23. He died when his Army fighter plane crashed while on a routine flight, training flight a few miles east of Selfridge Field, Michigan. He was born in Alabama, but he graduated from Hutchinson Central High School, and he was a student at West Virginia State College when he enrolled for the Air Force in October 21, 1942 as an aviation student and had completed his basic training with the Army Air Forces when he was killed. And he was survived by a wife, Esther. So he was really young at 23, and Lieutenant Henry Powler was only 25 when he passed away. So unfortunately, there were very young men, as we know, that served during World War II, and some of them had their lives shortened and gave their lives for the country.
And serving 4 years in the Air Force, of course, it was a throw when we learned about the Tuskegee Airmen. And I will say that all of the bomber pilots that were escorted with the P-51 Tuskegee Airmen were very relaxed because they knew they were the best. And in that era, they earned the honors of being the best fighter squadron in the world, and they were that good at that time.
Oh, that's good. I know Robin Roberts of ABC Network, she's a commentator and is on Good Morning America, that her father was a Tuskegee Airman, and she's really proud of it. That's why I know. So so there's another group that really made a huge contribution in World War II.
I just want to mention, you know, we were talking about the AME Church, and we talked about the history of it, but I want to point out that the church is still open and is still active. It is the First African-American Episcopal Church of Lockport. That's its official name. And just about a year ago, just before quarantine started, the church hosted an international world-renowned singing group. They were called Angel Vox, and they were a gospel singing sensation from the Congo in Central Africa. And so they hosted that concert. And then in June, when things started opening up again after the quarantine, they were one of the first places in Lockport to host a COVID testing community day right at the church. So they have a very long history, but they're still very active and still a very vital part of the community today as well.
So, okay.
And as they're looking through their paperwork, I will remind you, 433-1433, if you have any calls, any comments. Today, the month is Black History Month, and I thought you ladies did a fantastic job presenting everything today, and especially Moselle, and then the people that did as much as Moselle did that didn't get mentioned, as both of you said, that Mr. Moselle, of course, you know, and every time you're on the show and we talk about him, well, he must have been a heck of a brick maker, because most of the bricks that were in Lockport were made by Mr. Moselle and his factory.
Yeah, he made a lot of buildings. A lot of the brick roads were his bricks, too. Yeah, so plus he did buildings in Hamilton, Ontario, and refaced some existing buildings with his bricks.
Now, do you have pictures in the History Center of Mr. Moselle's work, any of the buildings that he had built?
Just the commercial hotel.
And the church.
And the church, yeah.
Well, how about if we ask the folks out there, if any of you folks have any pictures of Mr. Moselle's work that he accomplished and the buildings that he built, give Melissa a call. Melissa, let the folks know how they can get a hold of you at the History Center.
Okay, they can call at 716-434-7433. They can go to niagarahistory.org, and Niagara has three A's in it. Or they could go to our website, which is www.niagarahistory.org, or they can email us either
info at
niagarahistory.org. And the reason we mention the three A's is because since Viagra, people have dropped
the middle A,
an A in Niagara, and even our corporate credit card is spelled incorrectly. Wow. But if people don't put three A's in when they type it, they're not going to get to where they need to go.
And tell us about the new addition that you have, the YouTube channel?
YouTube channel, and that is called, let's see.
I threw a curveball. We'll see if you can hit it.
That's all right. I've got it here. So it is the History Center Lockport on YouTube. We also have Facebook, which is the History Center of Niagara. And I know we have a, Snapchat?
Instagram, is it?
Instagram.
Is a Twitter.
We have Twitter.
Okay, Instagram,
Twitter is Niagara History Center.
All right.
I don't know if it's Snapchat we have.
Is it Snapchat? Okay.
Yeah, but I don't Snapchat, so I don't know. But we have a young employee who does.
I was going to say, Melissa sounds like me when it comes to all of this new fancy phone stuff, electronic stuff. I got a kick the other day. Somebody was asking me about electronics on my phone. I said, I'm still looking for the slot where to put my dime in.
it's interesting. But we have a young employee, so we can keep up with what we're supposed to be doing.
We've also gotten a couple of grants recently. I'll talk about the one for the education programs, and then maybe Melissa can talk about, we did get one for some computer equipment, I believe.
Well, so, we got one from JB Computer, right, donated that, but there's also another grant I can discuss.
But the Erie Canal National Heritage Corridor has awarded the History Center a grant for us to create virtual programming around the Erie Canal. Usually we get grant money through them for a program called Ticket to Ride, where the students actually come here to Lockport. The buses are paid for through the grant, and they come to the Erie Canal Discovery Center, and they have a tour of the Discovery Center, but they also have a walking tour around the locks. So they spend approximately an hour and a half learning all about the history of the Erie Canal, and also the locks here at Lockport and how they were constructed. And they get hands-on things at the Discovery Center, and they get to see the locks up close on the walking tour. But of course, last year in 2020, they weren't able to visit the Discovery Center or the locks. And so the Erie Canal National Heritage Corridor had provided grant money for these partners, because there are several museums along the Erie Canal that do this program, for us to create virtual programming so that this can be done in the classroom. Obviously, it doesn't take the place of actually being at the Discovery Center or seeing the locks in person, but at least it will enable teachers to teach about the Erie Canal and about Lockport. And so that program, we've been working on that since August, and we are just now finally just about completed all of the virtual lessons, and hopefully at the end of February it will be going live online for teachers to access, because the Erie Canal curriculum begins in March. So
also homeschoolers will be able to access.
Yes.
Now, as they are lowering the restrictions on the COVID, have you heard anything about, will there be lock tours this summer?
As far as school tours, I doubt it. I don't know about the individual lock tours that they do on the weekends. Melissa, do you know anything about that?
They're going to retrain the people in case that it is a viable program this year. So they're optimistic that because it is outside and because people will be masked and there will be social distancing, that they can accomplish some of the tours this summer.
3.5 minutes left, ladies. If you have anything to recap, now's the time to do it.
Well, we also got a DRI grant, which is a Downtown Revitalization Initiative grant. And that's from the Greater Lockport Development Corporation. And that will help at the Discovery Center, because
we built that in 2005, but some of the signs have passed their peak and one is ready to fall off. So we're going to redo the signs and we're going to do some reconfiguration inside the building to make it more accessible. So not only did we get the grant from the DRI program, but we also got a matching grant from the Greg Lewis Foundation. So we'll be able to do that work, and that probably will start in the summer or the early fall. So that we, even though we don't have a lot of people coming in, the gift shop is open. We are almost finished with the Belva Lockwood exhibit, and that's on the first floor, and you can safely come in and see that exhibit. The curator, Terry Abrams, has done a great job on that exhibit. So we're hoping that people will come in and look at it, go through the gift shop. We're have part of the exhibit is in the meeting room, and come in just for that. We do have small meetings going on of less than 10 people, and we have the room configured so that people are spread way apart.
Well, we do have a call coming in, so let's take that very quickly. Good morning. Sure. You're on Niagara County's Great History Show. You have about a minute and a half. You are on.
Good morning, Norm. This is Mary from Niagara Falls. Really enjoyed the show. I just wanted to make a quick statement that this being Black History Month, someone who's recently become part of Black History Month is Richie Houston, who used to reach out regularly to WLVL, both the History Show and also other shows, I think you know. And I just say he was so interested in the history of Lockport and lived it. So
Did he pass away?
Wanted to say it. He was someone who I was in touch with and often brought up the history of things that went on in Lockport.
I played baseball with his brothers, and I didn't. Did he pass away?
Yes.
Last month. He used to come into the History Center. He was very interested in Lower Town history. And he would come in and look at the pictures and that sort of thing. And obviously African-American history, but I guess he lived in Lower Town and wanted to see pictures of old Lower Town.
Well, thank you for letting us
know. We didn't realize that.
He was working on some things. I don't know if it'll ever see the light.
Well, thank you very much. We have
to
go.
Call us at the History Center if you need to talk more.
You have been listening to Niagara County's Great History Show on 1340 AM, 105.3 FM.
Even the Trump legal team praised them. I'm Dave Anthony, Fox News, and that made the former president furious. House Democrats prosecuting him at the impeachment trial will start making their case next hour, but Republican Senator Ted Cruz tells Fox,
and at the end of the day, it's not going to succeed. President Trump is going to be acquitted.
Fox's Jared Halpern's live at the Capitol.
The House managers will begin presenting their case, drawing links between what then-President Trump said in the aftermath of the 2020 election with a violent breach of the U.S. Capitol on January.